Chapter 1. I Am Born. Whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life, or whether that station will be held by anybody else, these pages must show. To begin my life with the beginning of my life, I record that I was born, as I have been informed and believe, on a Friday at 12 o'clock at night. It was remarked that the clock began to strike, and I began to cry simultaneously. How wonderful to be read to be carried from this world and into another, borne away on words. And Amy's voice as she told the story, that was the loveliest part. It flowed through him like a benign electric current. He could have listened to her forever, their bodies close together, his mind in two places simultaneously, both within the world of the story, with its wonderful rain of sensations, and here, with Amy, in the house in which they lived and always had, as if sleep and wakefulness were not adjacent states with firm boundaries, but part of a continuum. At length he realized that the story had stopped. Had he dozed off? Nor was he on the sofa any longer. In some manner, unaware, he had made his way upstairs. The room was dark, the air cold above his face. Amy was sleeping beside him. What was the hour? And what was this feeling he had? The sense that something was not right. He drew the blankets aside and went to the window. A lazy half-moon had risen, partially lighting the landscape. Was that movement there, at the edge of the garden? It was a man. He was dressed in a dark suit. Gazing upward at the window, he stood with his hands behind his back, in a posture of patient observation. Moonlight slanted across him, sharpening the angles of his face. Peter experienced not alarm, but a feeling of recognition, as if he had been waiting for this nighttime visitor. Perhaps a minute passed, Peter watching the man in the yard watching him. Then, with a courteous tip of his chin, the stranger turned away and walked off into the darkness. "Peter, what is it?" He turned from the window. Amy was sitting up in bed. "There was somebody out there," he said.
"Somebody?
Who?"
"Just a man.
He was looking at the house. But he's gone now." Amy said nothing for a moment. Then,
"That would be Fanning. I was wondering when he'd show up."
The name meant nothing to Peter. Did he know of Fanning?
"It's all right."
She drew the blanket aside for him.
"Come back to bed."
He climbed under the covers. At once, the memory of the man receded into unimportance. The warm pressure of the blankets and Amy beside him. These were all he needed.
"What do you think he wanted?" Peter asked.
"What does Fanning ever want?" Amy sighed wearily, almost with boredom.
"He wants to kill us."
Peter awoke with a start. He'd heard something. He drew a breath and held it.
The sound came again.
The creak of a floorboard underfoot. He rolled, reached his right hand to the floor, and took the weight of the pistol in his grip. The creak had come from the front hallway. It sounded like one person. They were trying to keep quiet. They didn't know he was awake. Surprise was therefore on his side. He rose and crossed the room to the front window. His security detail, two soldiers stationed on the porch, were gone. He thumbed off the safety. The bedroom door was closed. The hinges, he knew, were loud. The moment the door opened, the intruder would be alerted to his presence. He pulled the door open and moved at a quick step down the hall. The kitchen was empty. Without missing a stride, he turned the corner into the living room, extending the pistol. A man was seated in the old wooden rocker by the fireplace.
His face was turned partially away, his eyes focused on the last embers glowing in the grate. He appeared to take no notice of Peter at all. Peter stepped behind him, leveling the gun. Not a tall man, but solidly built, his broad shoulders filling the chair. "Show me your hands." "Good. You're awake." The man's voice was calm, almost casual. "Your hands, damn it!" "All right, all right." He held his hands away from his body, fingers spread. "Get up. Slowly." He lifted himself from his chair. Peter tightened the grip on his pistol. "Now face me." The man turned around.
"Holy shit," thought Peter. "Holy, holy shit."
"You think maybe you could stop pointing that thing at me?" Michael had aged. But of course they all had. The difference was that the Michael he knew, his mental image of the man, had leapt forward 2 decades in an instant. It was, in a way, like looking in a mirror. The changes you didn't notice in yourself were laid bare in the face of another. "What happened to the security detail?" "Not to worry. Their headaches will be historic, though. The shift changes it, too, in case you were wondering." Michael looked at his watch. 90 minutes. "Plenty of time, I'd say."
"What for?"
"A conversation."
"What did you do with our oil?"
Michael frowned at the gun. "I mean it, Peter. You're making me nervous." Peter lowered the weapon. "Speaking of which, I brought you a present." Michael gestured toward his pack on the floor. "Do you mind?"
"Oh, please. Make yourself at home."
Michael removed a bottle wrapped in stained oilcloth. He uncovered it and held it up for Peter to see. "My latest recipe. Should strip the lining right off your brain pan." Peter retrieved a pair of shot glasses from the kitchen. By the time he returned, Michael had moved the rocking chair to the small table in front of the sofa. Peter sat across from him. On the table was a large cardboard folder. Michael cut the wax on the bottle, poured 2 shots, and raised his glass. "Compadres," he said. The taste exploded into Peter's sinuses. It was like drinking straight alcohol. Michael smacked his lips appreciatively. "Not bad, if I do say so myself." Peter stifled a cough, his eyes brimming.
"So, did Dunk send you?"
"Dunk?" Michael made a sour face. "No. Our old friend Dunk is taking a very long swim with his cronies."
"I suspected as much."
"No need to thank me. Did you get the guns?"
"You left out the part about what they're for."
Michael picked up the folder and untied the cords. He withdrew 3 documents, a painting of some kind, a single sheet of paper covered in handwriting, and a newspaper. The masthead said, "International Herald Tribune." Michael poured a 2nd shot into Peter's glass and pushed it toward him. "Drink this."
"I don't want another."
"Believe me, you do." Michael was waiting for Peter to say something. His friend was standing at the window, looking out into the night, though Michael doubted he was seeing much of anything.
"I'm sorry, Peter. I know it's not good news."
"How can you be so damn sure?" "You're going to have to trust me."
"That's all you've got? Trust you? I'm committing about 5 felonies just talking to you."
"It's going to happen. The virals are coming back. They were never really gone to begin with."
"This is insane."
"I wish it were." Michael had never felt so sorry for anyone since the day he'd sat on the porch with Theo, a lifetime ago, and told him the batteries were failing.
"This other viral," Peter began.
"Fanning, the Zero."
"Why do you call him that?"
It's how he knows himself. Subject Zero, the first one infected. The documents Lacey gave us in Colorado described 13 test subjects, the 12 plus Amy. But the virus had to come from somewhere. Fanning was the host. So what's he waiting for? Why didn't he attack us years ago? All I know is I'm glad he didn't. It's bought us the time we needed. And Greer knows this because of some vision. Michael waited. Sometimes, he knew, that was what you had to do. The mind refused certain things. You had to let resistance run its course. 21 years since we opened the gate. Now you waltz in here and tell me it was all a big mistake. I know this is hard, but you couldn't know. No one could. Life had to go on. Just what would you have me tell people? Some old man had a bad dream, and I guess we're all dead after all? You're not going to tell them anything. Half of them won't believe you. The other half will lose their minds. It'll be pandemonium. Everything will fall apart. People will do the math. We only have room for 700 on the ship. To go to this island. Peter gestured dismissively at Greer's painting. This picture in his head. It's more than a picture, Peter. It's a map. Who really knows where it comes from? That's Greer's department, not mine. But he saw it for a reason. I know that much. You always seemed so goddamned sensible. Michael shrugged. I admit, the whole thing took some getting used to. But the pieces fit. You read that letter. The Bergensfjord was headed there. And just who decides who goes? You? You're the president. That's ultimately your call. But I think you'll agree. I'm not agreeing to anything. Michael took a breath. I think you'll agree that we need certain skills. Doctors, engineers, farmers, carpenters. We need leadership, obviously. So that includes you. Don't be absurd. Even if what you say is right, which is ridiculous, there's no way I'd go. I'd rethink that. We'll need a government, and the transition should be as smooth as possible. But that's a subject for later. Michael removed a small leather-wrapped notebook from his pack. I've drafted a manifest. There are some names, people I know who fit the bill, and we've included their immediate families. Age is a factor, too. Most are under 40. Otherwise, there are job descriptions grouped by category. Peter accepted the notebook, opened it to the first page, and began to read. Sarah and Hollis, he said. That's good of you. You don't have to be sarcastic. Caleb's in there, too, in case you were wondering. What about Apgar? I don't see him anywhere. The man is what? 65? Peter shook his head with a look of disgust. I know he's your friend, but we're talking about rebuilding the human race. He's also general of the army. As I said, these are just recommendations. But take them seriously. I've given the matter a lot of thought. Peter read the rest without comment, then looked up. What's this last category? These 56 spots? Those are my men. I've promised them places on the ship. I won't go back on that. Peter tossed the notebook onto the table. You've lost your mind. Michael leaned forward. This is going to happen, Peter. You need to accept it. And we don't have a lot of time. 20 years, and now this is a big emergency. Rebuilding the Bergensfjord took what it took. If I could have finished faster, I would have. We'd be long gone. And just how do you propose we get people to this boat of yours without starting a panic? Probably we can't. That's what the guns are for. Peter just stared at him. There are three options that I can see, Michael continued. The first is a public lottery for the available slots. I'm opposed to that, obviously. Option two is we make our selections, tell the people on the manifest what's happening, give them the choice of either staying or going, and do our best to keep order while we get them out of here. Personally, I think that would be a disaster. No way we could keep a lid on things, and the army might not back us. Option three is we tell the passengers nothing, apart from a few key individuals we know we can trust. We round up the rest and get them out in the dead of night. Once they're at the isthmus, we give them the good news that they're the lucky ones. Lucky? I can't believe we're even talking like this. Make no mistake, that's what they are. They'll get to live their lives. More than that, they'll be starting over someplace that's truly safe. And this boat of yours can actually get them there. This derelict. I hope she can. I believe she can. You don't sound convinced. We've done our best. But there aren't any guarantees. So those 700 lucky people might be going straight to the bottom of the ocean. Michael nodded. That might be exactly what happens. I've never lied to you, and I'm not going to start now. But she managed to cross the world once. She'll do it again. The conversation was broken by a burst of voices outside and three hard bangs on the door. Well, Michael said and clapped his knees. It looks like our time is over. Think about what I've told you. In the meanwhile, we need to make this look right. He reached into his pack and withdrew the Beretta. Michael, what are you doing? He pointed the gun half-heartedly at Peter. Do your best to act like a hostage. Two soldiers burst into the room. Michael rose to his feet, raising his hands. I surrender, he said, just in time for the closest one to take two long strides toward him, raise the butt of his rifle, and send it crashing into Michael's skull. 48. Rudy was hungry. Really fucking hungry. Hello, he called, pressing his face to the bars to aim his voice down the lightless corridor. Did you forget about me? Hey, assholes, I'm starving in here! Yelling was pointless. Nobody had been in the office since early afternoon. Not Fry and not Eustace either. Rudy plopped down on his bunk, trying not to think about his empty stomach. What he would have given for one of those stupid potatoes now. He rocked back on the cot and tried to get comfortable. There were lots of spots that still hurt. Every position Rudy tried made him ache in a different way. Okay, he'd pretty much asked for a beating. He wouldn't say he hadn't. But what would have happened if Fry hadn't gotten the door open? Dead Rudy, that's what. For a while, he drifted. Little squirts of liquid burbled in his gut. He wasn't sure what time it was. Late, probably, though without Fry coming back to bring him his meals, the day had lost its rhythm. He wouldn't have minded a book to occupy himself. If there were any light to see by, or if he could actually read, which he couldn't, having never understood the point of it. Fucking Gordon Eustace. More time slipped by. His mind was floating on the crest of sleep when a jolt of dread aroused him. Somewhere outside, a woman was screaming. The window was positioned high on the wall. Rudy had to stand on his tiptoes and grip the bars to keep his nose above the sill. There were lots of sounds now. Shots, shouts, screams. A darkened figure tore past the window. Then two more. Hey! Rudy yelled after them. Hey! I'm in here! Something was happening, and it was nothing good. He yelled some more, but nobody stopped or even answered. The screaming died down, and then picked up again, louder than before, a lot of people at once. Maybe it wasn't such a good idea to be telling everybody where he was, Rudy thought. He released his grip and backed away from the window. Whatever was going on out there, he was trapped like a rat in a can. Better to just shut up. The world went quiet again. Maybe a minute passed before Rudy heard the front door of the building open. He dropped to the floor and scrambled beneath the cot. The squeak of a chair, a shuffling sound, a drawer being opened. Somebody was searching for something. Then Rudy heard it. The jingling of keys. Sheriff? No answer. Deputy Fry? That you? A soft green light filled the corridor. Simultaneously, at the farthest outskirts of Mystic Township, Texas, three virals were emerging from the earth. Like pupae struggling free of their protective coverings, the members of the pod appeared in stages. First, the pearlescent tips of their claws, then the long bony fingers, followed by a busting of soil that laid bare their sleek, inhuman faces to the stars. They rose, shaking off the dirt with a dog-like motion, and stretched their slumberous limbs. A moment was required to ascertain their situation. It was night. They were in a field. The field was freshly turned. The first to emerge, the dominant member of the pod, was the widowed shopkeeper, George Pettibrew. The second was the town farrier, Juno Brand. The third was a 14-year-old girl from Hunt Township who had been taken up four nights ago when she'd made a midnight run to the outhouse of her family's farm. These identities lay beyond their powers of recollection, for they had none. All they had was a mission. They saw the farmhouse. A lazy curlicue of smoke chuffed from its chimney pipe. They circled the structure, taking stock. It possessed two doors, front and rear. Though it was not in their natures to bother with a door, nor with the dainty human custom of turning a handle. Such was their task that this was what they did. They entered. Their senses roamed the space. A sound from above. Somebody was snoring. The first viral, the alpha, crept up the stairs. So fine were his movements that not even a floorboard creaked. He barely parted air. The faint glow of a lantern issued from the room at the top, carelessly left burning after the house's inhabitants had retired for the night. In the big bed, two were sleeping, a man and a woman. The viral bent to the woman. She was on her left side, one arm crooked beneath the pillows, the second exposed upon the blankets. Under the subdued light of the lantern, her skin shimmered. Deliciously. The viral unlocked his jaws and lowered his face toward her. The barest prick, his teeth delicately sliding into the microscopic spaces of her flesh. And it was done. She stirred, moaned, rolled over. Perhaps she dreamed that she was pruning roses and got punctured by a thorn. The viral moved to the other side of the bed. Only the man's head and neck were exposed. The viral sensed as well that the man, whose snores rattled with a phlegmy texture, was not as deeply asleep as the woman. Leaning forward, the viral tilted his head to one side, as if to aim a kiss. The man's eyes flew open.
Holy fucking shit!
He shoved the palm of one hand against the viral's forehead to hold him at bay while reaching the other hand beneath the pillow.
Dory! He bellowed. Dory, wake up!
The viral was stunned into inaction. This was not how things were supposed to be. And that name, Dory, it jostled his mind. Did he know a Dory? Did he know the man as well? Had the two of them at one time been people in his life? And what was the man reaching for beneath his pillow? It was a gun. With a howl, the man shoved the barrel into the viral's mouth, pressing the muzzle up against his palate, and fired. A thunderclap, a parabola of blood, the viral's brain matter caroming through the crown of his skull to splatter on the ceiling. The body rocked forward, dead weight. The woman was awake now, immobilized with terror and screaming to beat the band. The other virals vaulted up the stairs. Shoving the corpse aside, the man fired at the first one as it burst through the door. He wasn't really aiming anymore. He was simply squeezing the trigger. The third shot connected in a general way, but that was the extent of it. Two more shots, and the hammer fell on an empty chamber. As one of the virals leapt toward him, the man grabbed the only thing he could think of, the kerosene lantern, and hurled it at his attackers. His aim was true. The viral exploded in flames. And then everything was on fire. The feeling hit Amy like a punch to the gut. She doubled over, the trowel falling from her hand, and dropped to her hands and knees in the dirt. "Amy, are you all right?" Carter was kneeling beside her. She tried to answer, but couldn't. Her breath stopped in her chest. "You hurtin' somewhere? Tell me what's wrong." At the same moment, Caleb Jackson awoke to the disconcerting smell of smoke. He had spent the night in a chair by the door, George's pistol on the table, his rifle cradled in his lap. His first thought was that his own house was burning. He jerked upright, panic pounding through him. But no, the room was all in order. The smell came from someplace else. He grabbed the pistol and stepped outside. To the west, beyond the ridgeline, the sky was lit with fire.
"Please, Miss Amy," Carter said. "You're scaring me." She was shaking. She could not speak. Such pain they felt. Such terror. So many. All at once.
Her breath unlocked. Air flowed back into her lungs.
"It started."
6. 0 hour. The fire, which seems extinguished, often slumbers beneath the ashes. Pierre Cornet, Rodagoon. 49. Just after daybreak, Caleb shook Pim by the shoulder. "Something's happened at the Tatums." She sat upright, instantly awake.
"What?"
Caleb opened the fingers of both hands and moved them in a rotating motion in front of his chest.
"Fire."
Pim shoved the blankets aside.
"I'm coming with you.
Stay here. I'll look."
"She's my friend."
Pim was referring to Dory, of course.
"Okay,"
he signed. The children were still out cold. While Pim dressed, Caleb awakened Kate to tell her what was happening.
"What do you think it means?"
Her voice was groggy, but her eyes were clear. "I don't know." He pulled the revolver from his waistband and held it out. "Keep this handy."
"Any idea what I'm supposed to be shooting at?"
"If I knew, I'd tell you. Stay inside. We won't be long." Caleb met Pim in the yard. She was gazing toward the ridgeline, hands on her hips. A thick column of white smoke, the color of a summer cloud, billowed at a distance. The color meant the fire was out.
"Jeb,"
she signed. The horse was lying where he had fallen. Handsome had wandered to the far end of the paddock, keeping his distance. "He died last night." Pim's face was all business.
"How?"
"Maybe colic. I didn't want to upset you."
"I'm your wife."
She signed these words with brisk anger.
"I saw you give Kate a gun. Tell me what's happening."
Caleb had no answer. All that remained of the farmhouse was a pile of charred timbers and glowing ash. The heat had been so intense that the glass in the windows had melted. It would be several hours, perhaps a day, before Caleb could look for bodies, though he doubted there'd be anything left but bones and teeth.
"Do you think they got out?"
Pim asked. Caleb could only shake his head. How had it happened? A loose ember from the stove? A lantern knocked aside? Something small. And now they were gone. He noticed something else. The paddock was empty. The gate stood open. The ground around it looked scraped, as if someone had killed the horses and dragged the carcasses away. What did it mean? Let's check the barn, he signed. Caleb entered first. It took his eyes a moment to adjust to the darkness. At the rear, in deep shadow, was a hump on the floor. It was Dory. She was lying in a fetal position. Her hair was burned away, brows and lashes gone, her face swollen and scorched. Her nightdress was charred in places, in others fused to her flesh. Her right arm and both legs were blackened to a crisp. Elsewhere the skin had bubbled, as if boiled from within. He knelt beside her. Dory, it's Caleb and Pim. Her right eye opened the thinnest crack. The other seemed welded shut. She flicked her gaze toward him. From her throat came a sound, half moan, half gurgle. Caleb couldn't imagine such agony. He wanted to be ill. Pim brought a bucket and ladle. She knelt beside Dory, cupped the woman's head to lift it slightly, and held the ladle to her lips. Dory managed a small sip, then sputtered the rest from her mouth. We have to get her back, Pim sighed. Kate will know what to do. That the woman was still alive was a miracle. Surely she would not survive long. Still, they had to try. A wheelbarrow stood propped against the wall. Caleb rolled it over and fetched a pair of saddle pads from the tack bin and laid them in the bottom. Take her legs. Caleb positioned himself behind Dory and hooked his elbows under her shoulders. The woman began to shriek and buck at the waist. After the longest 5 seconds of his life, they managed to get her into the wheelbarrow. A tacky substance came away on Caleb's bare forearms. Pieces of Dory's skin. Her cries subsided. She was breathing in shallow, rapid jerks. The trip would be unbearable for her. Each jostle would bring fresh waves of torture. As Caleb hoisted the bars of the wheelbarrow, he saw another problem. Dory was not a small woman. Keeping the whole thing balanced would take every ounce of his strength. Give me a side, Pim signed. Caleb shook his head firmly. The baby. I'll stop if I'm tired. Caleb didn't want to, but Pim wouldn't be deterred. They rolled Dory to the door. As sunlight fell across her, her whole body recoiled, sending the wheelbarrow tipping dangerously to the side. It's her eyes, Pim sighed. They must be burned. She returned to the barn and came back with a cloth, which she moistened in the bucket and then draped over the upper half of the woman's face. Her body began to relax. Let's go, Pim sighed. It took almost an hour to get Dory back to the house, by which time the woman had lapsed into a merciful unconsciousness. Kate rushed out to meet them. When she saw Dory, she turned back toward the door, where Al and Bug were standing watchfully, curious about all the excitement. Theo was nosing through Bug's legs like a puppy. Get back in the house, she ordered, and take your cousin with you. We want to look, Al whined. Now. They faded inside. Kate crouched next to Dory. Dear God. We found her in the barn, Caleb explained. Her husband? No sign of him. Kate looked toward Pim. The girls shouldn't see. Pim nodded. I'll take them out back. We need a tarp or strong blanket, Kate said to Caleb. We can put her in the back room, away from the children. Will she survive? She's a mess, Caleb. There's not a lot I can do. Caleb retrieved one of the heavy wool blankets he used for the horses. They spread it on the ground next to the wheelbarrow, then lifted Dory from the cart and lowered her onto the blanket, tied the corners together, and ran a length of 2x4 through the ends to fashion a makeshift sling. As they hoisted her off the ground, she made a noise from back in her throat that sounded like a strangled scream. Caleb shuddered.
He could barely listen to this anymore. That Dory hadn't died seemed a cruelty of immense proportions. They carried her into the house, to the small storage room where the girls had been sleeping, and laid her on the pallet. Caleb nailed a saddle pad to the tiny window as a shade.
I need to get that nightgown off.
Kate gave Caleb a grave look.
This will be bad.
He swallowed. He could barely bring himself to look at the woman, at her charred and bubbled flesh.
I'm not good with things like this, he admitted. Nobody is, Caleb.
He realized something else. He'd waited too long. Now they were stranded, waiting for the woman to die. With only one horse, they couldn't use the buckboard to take Dory to Mystic. And Pym would never leave her.
I'll need clean cloths, a bottle of alcohol, scissors, Kate commanded. Boil the scissors and don't touch them afterward. Just lay them in a cloth. Then go look after the children. Pym can help me here. You'll want to keep them away from the house for a while.
Caleb didn't feel insulted, only grateful. He retrieved the things she'd asked for, brought them to the room, and traded places with Pym. By the kitchen garden, the girls were playing with their dolls, making beds for them out of leaves and sticks, while Theo toddled around.
Come on, children. Let's go for a walk to the river.
He lodged Theo on his hip and took Elle by the hand. She, in turn, took her sisters, as they had learned to do, making a chain. They were halfway to the river when a scream severed the air. The sound shot through Caleb like a bullet.
Lucius, it started. I need you now.
Greer had been driving since before dawn. Just get this boat ready, he'd told Lore. He swung past Rosenberg in the dark, jogged northwest, and hit Highway 10 as the sun was rising behind him. He would reach Kerrville by 4 o'clock, 5 at the latest.
What would the darkness bring?
Amy, I am coming.
50. Michael came to consciousness in darkness. Lying on his bunk, he fingered the wound on his head. His hair was rigid with dried blood. He was lucky they hadn't broken his skull. But he supposed an armed criminal in the president's house warranted at least one good blow to the melon. Not an ideal way to get a night's rest, though, on the whole, not entirely unwelcome. He slept some more. When he awoke, soft daylight was coming through the window. A clunk of tumblers and a pair of DS officers appeared. One was holding a tray. While the other stood guard, the first placed the tray on the floor.
Much obliged, guys.
The two walked off. Probably they'd been instructed not to talk to him. Michael lifted the tray and put it on the bunk. A bowl of boiled oats, scrambled eggs, a peach. A better meal than he'd had in days. They'd given him only a spoon. No fork, of course, so he ate the eggs with that, followed by the porridge. He saved the peach for last. Juice exploded over his chin.
Fresh fruit. He'd forgotten what it was like.
More time passed. At last he heard footsteps and voices in the hall. Peter, most likely, with someone else in tow. Apgar? Sooner or later, the conversation was going to have to widen. But it wasn't Peter. Sarah stood in the doorway. She'd changed less than he would have thought. Older, of course, but she'd aged gracefully, the way some women could. The ones who didn't fight it, who accepted the passage of time.
I don't believe my eyes.
Hello, Sarah. Michael sat up on his bunk as his sister stepped inside. She was carrying a small leather bag. A guard moved in behind her, holding a baton.
God damn it, Michael.
She was standing apart from him.
I know.
An absurd remark.
What did it mean?
I know I hurt you. I know how this must look. I know I'm the worst brother in the world.
I am so angry at you.
You have a right. An eyebrow lifted.
That's all you have to say.
How about
I'm sorry.
Are you kidding me? You're sorry?
You look well, Sarah. I've missed you. Don't even try. And you look like hell.
Oh, this is one of my better days.
Michael, what are you doing here? I thought I'd never see you again.
He searched her face. Did she know? What did Peter tell you?
Just that you'd been arrested and you had a gash in your head.
She lifted the bag a little.
I'm here to sew you up.
So he didn't say anything else. She made a face of disbelief.
Like what, Michael? That they'll probably hang you? He didn't have to.
Don't worry. Nobody's getting hanged.
21 years, Michael.
Her right hand, the one not holding the bag, was clenched into a fist, as if she might strike him.
21 years without a message, a letter, nothing. Help me understand this.
I can't explain right now, but you have to know there was a reason.
Do you know what I had to do? Do you? 10 years ago, I said, that's it. He's never coming back. He might as well be dead. I buried you, Michael. I put you in the ground and forgot about you.
I did some awful things, Sarah. At last, the tears came.
I took care of you. I raised you. Did you ever think of that?
He rose from the bunk. Sarah let the bag drop to the floor, raised her fists, and began to pummel his chest. She was crying in earnest now.
You asshole, she said.
He pulled her into a tight embrace. She struggled in his arms, then let him hold her. The guard was watching them warily. Michael shot him a look. Back off.
How could you do this to me? She sobbed.
I never wanted to hurt you, Sarah.
You left me, just like they did. You're no better than they were.
I know.
Damn you, Michael. Damn you.
He held her that way for a long time.
That's quite a story. It was late morning. Peter had cleared the office. He and Apgar were seated at the conference table, waiting for Chase. A short retirement for the man, thought Peter.
I know it is, Peter answered.
Do you believe him?
Do you?
You're the one who knows the man.
That was 20 years ago.
Chase appeared in the door.
Peter, what's going on? Where is everybody? This place is a tomb.
He was dressed in the jeans, work shirt, and heavy boots of the cattleman he had announced his intention to become.
Have a seat, Ford, Peter said.
Will this take long? Olivia's waiting for me. We're meeting some people at the bank. Peter wondered how many of these conversations he was going to have. It was like leading people to the edge of a cliff, showing them the view, and then shoving them off.
I'm afraid so, he said.
Alicia saw the first mounds just outside of Fredericksburg. 3 domes of earth, each the length of a man, bulging from the ground in the shade of a pecan tree. Riding on, she came to the outermost farmstead. She dismounted in the packed dirt yard. No sounds of life reached her from the house. She stepped inside. Furniture overturned, objects strewn about, a rifle on the floor, beds unmade. The inhabitants had been infected as they'd slept. Now they slept in the earth, beneath the pecan tree. She watered Soldier at the trough and continued on her way. The rocky hills rose and fell. Soon she saw more houses, some nestled discreetly in the folds of the land, others exposed on the flats, surrounded by hard-won fields of newly tilled soil. There was no need to look more closely. The stillness told Alicia all she needed to know. The sky seemed to hang above her with an infinite weariness. She had expected it to happen like this, at the outer edges first. The first ones taken up, then more and more. An army swelling its ranks, metastasizing as it moved toward the city.
The town itself was abandoned. Alicia rode the length of the dusty main street, past the small stores and houses, some new, others reclaimed from the past. Just a few days ago, people had gone about their daily lives here, raised families, conducted business and trade, talked of small things, gotten drunk, cheated at cards, argued, fought with their fists, made love, stood on the porches to greet their fellow citizens as they passed. Had they known what was happening? Did the fact creep upon them slowly? First one person missing, a curiosity barely remarked on, then another and another, until the meaning dawned. Or had the virals swooped down in a rush, a single night of horror? At the southern edge of town, Alicia came to a field. She began to count. 20 mounds. 50. 75. At 100, she gave up counting. 51. The day moved on. Still, Dory did not die. From the room where the woman lay, Caleb heard only small sounds, moans, murmurs, a chair shifting on the floor. Kate or Pim might appear briefly to fetch some small implement or boil more cloths. Caleb sat in the yard with the children, though he had no energy to amuse them. His mind drifted to undone chores. But then another voice would speak to him, saying it was for naught. They would soon be leaving this place. All his proud hopes dashed. Kate came out and sat beside him on the stoop. The children had gone down for a nap in the house. So? He asked. Kate squinted into the afternoon light. A strand of hair, golden blonde, was plastered to her forehead. She tucked it away. She's still breathing, anyway. How long will this take? She should be dead already. Kate looked at him. If she's still alive in the morning, you should take Pim and the kids and get out of here. If anybody's staying, it's me. Just tell me what to do. Caleb, I can handle it. I know you can, but I'm the one who got us into this mess. What were you going to do? A horse gets sick, some people go missing, a house burns down. Who's to say any of it's related? I'm still not leaving you here. And believe me, I appreciate the gesture. I never was much of a country gal, and this place gives me the creeps. But it's my job, Caleb. Let me do it, and we'll get along fine. For a while, they sat without talking. Then Caleb said, I could use your help with something. Jeb's body had swollen and stiffened in the heat. They lashed his hind legs together, set Handsome into his plow harness, and began the slow process of dragging the body to the far edge of the field. When Caleb felt they were far enough away from the house, they led Handsome back to the shelter and brought out one of the jugs of fuel. Caleb dragged some deadfall from the woods and placed it over the corpse, building a pyre. He splashed kerosene over it, recapped the can, and stepped back. Kate asked, Why did you call him Jeb? Caleb shrugged. Just the name he came with. Nothing remained to be said. Caleb struck a match and tossed it forward. With a whoosh, flames enveloped the pile. There was no wind to speak of. The thick smoke rose straight skyward, full of popping sparks. For a while, it smelled like mesquite. Then it became something else. That's that, I guess, he said. They walked back toward the house. As they approached, Pim appeared in the doorway. Her eyes were very wide. Something is happening, she signed. The room was cool and dark. Only Dory's face was showing. The rest was covered by boiled clothes. Mrs. Tatum, Kate said, can you hear me? Do you know where you are? Staring at the ceiling, the woman seemed completely unaware of them. A remarkable change had occurred. Remarkable, but also disturbing. The harsh appearance of the burns on her face had softened. Their color was now pinkish, almost dewy. In other patches, Her skin was white as talc. Dory shifted slightly in her bed, exposing her left hand and forearm from under the cloths. Before, it had been a gruesome claw of cooked flesh. In its stead was a recognizable human hand. Blisters gone, charred bits flaked off to reveal skin of rosy newness beneath. Kate looked up at Pym. How long has she been awake?
She wasn't. That just happened.
Mrs. Tatum, Kate said, more commandingly, I'm a doctor. You've been in a fire. You're at the Jackson's farm. Caleb and Pym are with me. Do you remember what happened?
Her gaze, wandering the room in a desultory fashion, located Kate's face.
Fire? She murmured.
That's right. There was a fire at your house.
Ask her if she knows what started it, Caleb said.
Fire, Dory repeated. Fire.
Yes. What do you remember about the fire? Pym stepped forward and knelt by the bed. She gently lifted Dory's exposed hand, placed the tip of her index finger in the woman's palm, and began to form letters.
Pym, Dory said.
But that was all. The light in her eyes faded. She closed them again.
Caleb, I'm going to examine her, Kate said.
Then, to Pym, stay and help. Caleb waited in the kitchen. The children, mercifully, were still asleep. A few minutes passed, and the women appeared. Kate gestured to the back door. Let's talk outside. The light had shifted toward evening.
What's happening to her?
Caleb asked, signing simultaneously.
She's getting better, that's what.
How is that possible? If I knew, I'd bottle it. The burns are still bad. She's not out of the woods yet. But I've never seen anybody heal so fast. I thought the shock alone would kill her.
What about her waking up like that?
It's a good sign, her recognizing Pym. I don't think she understood much else, though.
She may never.
You mean she'll stay like this?
I've seen it happen.
Kate addressed her sister directly.
You should stay with her.
If she wakes up again, try to get her talking.
What about?
Easy stuff. Keep her mind off the fire for now. Pym returned to the house.
This changes things, Caleb said.
I agree. We may be able to move her sooner than I thought. Do you think you can find a vehicle in Mystic? He recalled the pickup he'd seen in Ilaqua's yard. Kate seemed surprised.
Brian Ilaqua?
That's him.
That drunken old cuss. I'd wondered what had become of him.
That was pretty much my experience of the man.
Still, I'm sure he'd help us.
Caleb nodded. I'll ride in the morning. Sarah was waiting on the porch with their bags when Hollis appeared, sitting atop a sorry-looking mare. With him was a man Sarah didn't know, riding a second horse, a black gelding with a back as bowed as a hammock and ancient runny eyes.
What's this I see? Sarah said.
Oh, two of the worst horses I ever laid eyes on. The two men dismounted. Hollis's companion was a squat-looking man wearing overalls but no shirt. His hair was long and white. There was something cunning in his face. Hollis and the man exchanged a few words, shook hands, and the man walked off.
Who's your friend? Sarah asked.
Hollis was tying the horses to the porch rail.
Just somebody I knew in the old days.
Husband, I thought we talked about a truck.
Yeah, about that. Turns out a truck costs actual money. Also, there's no gas to be had. On the upside, Dominic threw in the tack for free, so we are not technically 100% penniless at the moment.
Dominic, your shirtless friend.
He kinda owed me a favor.
Should I ask?
Probably best if you don't.
They returned to the house, lightened their gear, loaded the remains into saddlebags, and secured them to the horses. Hollis took the mare, Sarah the gelding. She was getting the best of the deal, though not by much.
Years had passed since she'd even been on a horse, but the feeling was automatic, touching a deep chord of physical memory. Bending forward in the saddle, Sarah gave three firm pats to the side of the horse's neck.
"You're not such a bad old guy, are you? Maybe I'm being too hard on you."
Hollis looked up. "I'm sorry, were you addressing me?"
"Now, now," Sarah said.
They made their way to the gate and descended the hill. Scattered workers were toiling in the fields beneath a late afternoon sun. Here and there, a pennant still hung limply from its pole, marking the location of a hard box. The watchtowers, with their warning horns and sharpshooter platforms, jutted from the valley floor, unmanned for years. At the outer edge of the orange zone, the road forked, west toward the river townships, east toward Comfort and the oil road. Hollis drew up and took his canteen from his belt. He drank and passed it to Sarah. "How's the old boy doing?"
"A perfect gentleman."
She wiped her mouth with the back of her hand and gestured eastward with the canteen.
"Looks like somebody's in a hurry."
Hollis saw it too, the boiling dust plume of a vehicle driving fast toward the city.
"Maybe we could see if he'd trade for the horses," Hollis said, not seriously.
Sarah examined him for a moment, flicking her eyes up and down.
"I have to say, you look rather dashing up there. Takes me back a bit."
Hollis was leaning forward, bracing his weight with both hands on the pommel.
"I used to like to watch you ride, you know. If I was on the day shift on the watch, I'd sometimes wait on the wall until you came back with the herd."
"Really? I was not aware."
"It was a little creepy of me, I admit that."
She felt suddenly happy. A smile came to her face, the first in days.
"Oh, what could you do?"
"I wasn't the only one. Sometimes you drew quite a crowd."
"Then lucky you, things working out like they did."
She capped the canteen and handed it back.
"Now let's go see our babies."
52.
"Hey, good afternoon, everybody."
Two DS officers manned the stockade's outer room, one sitting at his desk, a second, much older, standing behind the counter. Greer recognized the second one immediately. Years ago, the man had been one of his jailers.
Winthrop?
No, Winfield. He'd been just a kid then. As their gazes locked, Lucius could see a series of rapid calculations unfolding behind the man's eyes.
"I'll be damned,"
Winfield said. His hand dropped to his sidearm, but the movement was startled and clumsy, giving Greer ample time to raise the shotgun from beneath his coat and level it at the man's chest. With a loud clack, he chambered a shell.
"Tut, tut."
Winfield froze. The younger one was still sitting behind his desk, staring wide-eyed. Greer nudged the shotgun toward him.
"You, weapon on the floor. You too, Winfield. Let's be quick now."
They placed their pistols on the ground.
"Who is this guy?"
the younger one said.
"Been a while, 62, Winfield said, using Greer's old inmate number. He seemed more amused than angry, as if he'd run into an old friend of dubious reputation who'd lived up to expectations. "Heard you've been keeping yourself busy. How's Dunk?"
"Michael Fisher," Greer said. "Is he here?"
"Oh, he's here all right."
"Any more DS in the building?"
"We keep the nonsense to a minimum. This doesn't have to be a problem."
"Are you serious?"
"I don't give a shit one way or the other. Ramsey, toss me the keys."
Winfield opened the door to the cell block. Greer followed a few paces behind the two men, keeping the shotgun trained on their backs. Michael, lying on his bunk, rose on his elbows as the door to his cell opened.
"This is sudden," he remarked.
Greer ordered Winfield and the other one into the cell, then looked at Michael.
"Shall we?"
"Nice seeing you, 62, Winfield called after them. "You haven't changed a bit, you fucker."
Greer shut the door, turned the lock, and pocketed the key.
"Keep it down in there," he barked through the slot. "I don't want to have to come back here."
He turned to look at Michael.
"What happened to your head? That looks like it hurt." Not to sound ungrateful, but I'm thinking your being here is not good news. We're moving to Plan B. I didn't know we had